'cause we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers number
one. Hello everyone, you're listening to Battle Red Radio. My name is Matt Weston, and tonight I'm joined by our good friend from across the Pacific, and then you go across Asia, and then you come all the way back around the Atlantic to a different island in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere. I think that's where it is, but our good friend who lives all the way on the other side of the world, Luke. How are you doing tonight, man?
I'm doing great, Matt. How are you? And also, should I say for the record that the three or four members of the podcast, or sorry, the three or four listeners of the podcast who believe that the Earth is flat just clicked off immediately after that.
I think everybody listens to the podcast probably believes the Earth is flat, because that's the only way that I'm a very dumb man. And so if I'm giving anybody anything interesting to hear about, they have to be even dumber than I am. And I think that's the only way that works out. So I think it's more like, you know, 10,000 people are flat Earth people, because that's how many listeners we get for every show, you know.
Also, I think there's a weird kind of correlation between flat earthers and people who think maybe the Houston Texans offense could maybe or so.
Yeah. Yeah, my thing I've been saying lately now with the Texans offense is that you think the Texans offense is good if your only frame of reference is the Houston Texans offense.
It's just if you want to be like super small worlded about it and just don't like, the outside world is a mystery. I shall not examine it. All I need is what's in front of me.
Yeah.
You can get some very positive, or you can draw some positive conclusions for that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you go outside and see, oh, wait, what's that? Oh, it's Todd Gurley. Oh, wait a minute. Is that like three wide receiver sets? What are those? Never seen these before.
It was unbelievable in that during that Denver game to flip from the Broncos game over to Rams Saints, and it was two entirely different worlds. And I was like, yeah, there is the Texans as like a middle class team, and then there's the wealthy and the elite way up there, and it's not even close. And where you look at the offenses between, you know, those three football teams, just how fast and like smart and how well they attack matchups, how easy they open up throws and the talent they have, and like at every skill position. And it's super unfair. And we're all like, all of us who watched that Texans Broncos game instead of Rams Saints, you know, that's a tarnishment to our legacies. We'll have to carry that throughout our family trees. And we brought shame and ridicule onto the people who are going to come after us as well for watching Texans Broncos instead of Rams Saints last Sunday.
Well, that's true. But then again, we also have to come to grips with the fact that we've watched far too much AFC South football for both our own hats. Like, again, the fact that we missed out on Rams Saints just to watch Texans Broncos, and also the fact that we've watched how many Jags Texans games? Like, how many times have we seen Blake Bortles check down to TJ Yeldon or whichever running back is currently just revolving through Jacksonville right now?
Yeah. No, the worst game by far is the Tennessee-Jacksonville games, because those games are always 13-7. The uniforms are terrible. Like the one they played this year when both teams were supposed to be, you know, pretty good in week three, they went 11 for 32 on third downs that game. Like each team punted 13 times, and the Jags lost like 9-6. And like it shouldn't happen at all anymore. It's 2018, and, you know, it's postmodernism. Everything's absurd, and to play a 9-6 football game in week three. Also, nobody could tackle or do anything right either. It's just so hilariously stupid.
Yeah. I actually like to think of the way in which the AFC South has kind of gone this year. And the Texans is like a John Travolta gift from Pulp Fiction, where it's just like standing around, looking around, just going like, wait, where did all the other good teams go? Wait, am I the only one here? Oh, no. It's just like standing there with his jacket and just like Blake Bortles is running away off to the side or something like that.
Yeah, and then they go in the playoffs and somebody just shoots them with a machine gun when they walk out of the bathroom. That's entering the past. Yeah. So that's the perfect metaphor. So anyways, we're doing a show today because it's the Tyler Ervin emergency, he got cut broadcast episode. And then we'll do some bi-week thoughts just in general. And then we'll give out kind of some silly awards for the Texans and then also football in general too. Some real hard-hitting stuff like you know, ranking our favorite rookie quarterbacks, our favorite statistical quirks. And then from there, we may talk a little bit about the bye week and some plans. And then after that, I'm going to go leave here and then record a week 10 preview with another friend of mine. So we'll have a lot of podcasts this weekend for you all, you pumpkin patch pit, or man, that's a hard thing to say. Pumpkin patch pick, nose patch picks, whatever you're going to do this weekend, you'll have like 3 hours of Blog Talk Radio to listen to. Actually, probably two. We're going to keep it to two, but you'll have 2 hours to listen to this weekend.
That was some very, very fancy alliteration there, Matthew.
Pumpkin patch pick. I'm just so bad at talking. So anyways, like my big question for you right now, and I guess it's kind of the question I've been asking every Texans fan that I meet and that I know, even the ones that I don't care about their opinion of at all, like some of the people in some group texts I'm in. I've asked them the same question, though, is what is the biggest reason why the Texans went from 0-3 to 6-3?
Okay, well, before that, we all have to pay our respects to both Tyler Irvin and the mythical edge position in which he was supposed to play 3 seasons ago. Rip those two. I don't think it's you're going to find any singular focus just like, oh, this is the one thing that happened that kind of shifted the fortunes of Texans. Again, I think it's been kind of a menagerie of different things. I think the first 3 weeks, the Texans kind of caught it rough. Like the start against the Patriots was never going to be good. And I think the loss as a whole just hit the team quite hard. And I think hit the conceptualization of just, oh, we thought we were going to be a little bit better than this. And then the Patriots coming in and make you feel like poop. It's kind of one of those things that I think it took a week to kind of recover from that, and the fact that the offensive line as a whole was just capitulating straight there. So all of the stuff that you would kind of expect to happen from last year, in which case Deshaun Watson would have time to throw, he would be able to pick out, he would be able to pick passes a lot easier. That stuff just wasn't happening. Now there are a couple of different reasons that I could kind of point to and say kind of need to orientate back to what has worked in the past. And weirdly enough, by regression, he's actually progressed the team's fortunes. So he's brought. I'm essentially thinking of it like he's brought it back to what he didn't want to bring it towards, which is a really weird concept. But think about it like this: Deshaun, for the first 5 games of the season, Deshaun Watson threw over 30 passes in each of those first 5 games. 2 of them the Texans won, 3 of them they lost. Past 4 games in which the Texans have all won, and Deshaun Watson has thrown 9 touchdowns and 2 interceptions, he hasn't thrown 25 passes in those 4 games. There is definitely a kind of reconceptualization of what the offensive flow should be. I think Bill O'Brien's kind of realized, okay, the run game has to be placed a lot more to the fore, just so it actually creates play-action opportunities, which are a little bit more credible. So you can actually buy time for quarterback you have to do the thing that he's really good at, which is get outside of the pocket, make plays, and make those throws. There have been a bunch of different elements which have kind of coexisted around that. The fact that you've had Will Fuller healthy, the fact that you had Will Fuller healthy, the fact that you had Kiki Kuti's emergence, you had Jordan Thomas appearing also, and DeAndre Hopkins being as really good as he always is. The team was always really, really talented. It's just all of those factors and all of those pieces never kind of like coalesced together to create some kind of coherency. And the fact that they all kind of got together for a sustained period of time was like, okay, if we put all these things together, there's a chance here that this team is actually too talented to really, like, there's a threshold of how bad it can get. And I think they've shown that they've reached that over the past couple of weeks. I think some of the 1 or 2 score games could have been a bit more of a comfortable margin. But then again, that's a few other issues that Bill O'Brien, I think, is supposed to kind of figure out. As a whole, I think the team has, like, that's kind of the good things to focus on, which is Bill O'Brien's mature. Bill O'Brien has, like, noticed what's gone wrong with the team, and he's gone about and tried to correct it, and successfully done so in a bunch of different situations. The other point here on this, and if you're being a pessimist about this, you can look at the quarterbacks in the Texans during the time, and you can say, oh dear God, what have they played? This is giving me flashbacks to watching like 2014, whenever Brian Hoyer and Ryan Mallett were in a death grip for the Texans. Like, let's put it in this context. You had Josh Allen, who was in his second career start. You had Dak Prescott, who was like in a weird kind of funk. And if I can pull up the numbers from that game, I think his passer rating was quite low.
I think he threw like 192 yards that game too.
Yeah, and it was so weird because the next week later he went on and dropped 40, and he was part of the Dallas Cowboys team that put 40 points on the Jaguars.
And I think he threw like 186 yards in that game as well. It was like the Mitchell Trubisky stat line where he threw like 170 yards and scored 40 points somehow.
Exactly. So like Prescott in the Texans game was 18 to 29 for 208, one touchdown, two interceptions, and a rating of 66.5. It's not exactly great. Like, let's not lie to ourselves. Texans have not been playing good quarterbacks, and you can kind of just summarize that down. Well, they're beating bad quarterbacks, and in this league, you kind of take whatever wins you can come by. Yeah, you can, and that's all well and good. The AFC South is literally built upon can you beat bad teams? And the Texans are kind of living up to the yeah, we can do that. Whether or not they can actually be good against other teams, teams with better quarterbacks, better offensive systems, better ways of attacking defenses, remains to be seen. I should also state the fact that they also beat Nathan Peterman, or actually Nathan Peterman won them the game. I love Nathan Peterman so much. That guy is like one of the most resounding things. I'm going to try and find the quote that he had post-Texans game, which was like the most defeatist thing you'd ever heard in your entire life. Like he it is somebody that had kind of just, he had come like face to face with death and was okay with his own mortality. It was just like, I'm cool with this. I'm ready to just live out the rest of my days. It's just like, I'm done.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about, where he played so bad. He had to talk himself back into believing in God. That's how low it was.
Just like there's a reason for all this. I'm sure of it. But it was just so fantastic. And then of course the game against Miami, which you can't obviously reference the quarterback play of that game. All I will say is that I watched the previous two games that he played against Chicago and Detroit, and that made my eyes bleed, I should say. It's really kind of weird, the fact that when you consider the fact that Texans also played Eli Manning, that they didn't win that game also. They should probably be 7-2, but that's a different case. But yeah, like they played bad teams, but they've won. Mm-hmm. So they're going to make the playoffs, but are they a good team? I don't think there's a weird confidence there. I should also mention on the defensive side, Romeo Cornell's made it really, 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 he's done really well kind of readjusting to some of the stuff that he did well before Vrabel was in charge. So he's from A-gap blitzes. He's actually got really good safeties, which are a big important part of 4-4. He's still giving up a lot of easy short throws, but the Texans rating against the deep ball in particular is actually very, very good. Is reasonably good. They rank 12th amongst all teams in deep passes percentage according to Football Outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, you could look at that and say they're 28th against the short pass, which is understandable because cover four.
And that's a much better world to live in too, where you're better against the deep ball than the short passes, especially with like the type of offense that they have.
Yeah, for sure. I will make the point, deep ball passes as a whole are, think about it in terms of basketball and the three-point shot. Now, well, the three-point shot is like ridiculously common now. A couple of years ago and like a couple of maybe decades ago, we would look at it as being a low percentage look, something which doesn't really happen that often. It's not really a bankable kind of thing. It's like, hey, we're going to draw up a possession or we're going to draw up a play which is going to get this specific look, which might be, say, a 20 to 30% chance of success. Whereas if we draw up a look that's got for, say, a 5-yard out route, the chances of success on that are incrementally higher because it's less distance that the ball has to be thrown and closer receiver. Essentially, it's a lot easier. So you might be looking at 50-60% chance. So in my head, I kind of rationalize it like that. Like, sure, it's great to reduce the amount of deep balls that you're conceding, but you're conceding, you're proactively trying to stop something which is a rarity as a whole. It might only happen 1 in 4, like, it might only happen maybe 10-15% of the time, maybe even less than that. So what you're doing there is you're prioritizing that over the 50 or 60% look, which will give the offense 5 or 6 yards every single time. Mm-hmm. Like, if you think about it in terms of screen passes and short yardage routes, like curls, slants, and outs, which a receiver can catch the ball and get it to the field. With the cover four system that the Texans play, they play off man. So if they catch the ball short, what the cornerbacks are essentially taught to do is read the man, crash on the ball. So when the man essentially turns on, like, say, a curl route, returns for an out route, the corners are essentially supposed to crash on that. They're supposed to close as fast as they can. That's all well and good until you see the fact that your corners are Sharice Wright and Jonathan Joseph. Now, Joseph is still great, and he can actually do he can close very well on some of those things, but he can't do it with the same gusto that he used to. So if you're creating short yardage spaces, you're creating potential yards after catch. You're creating potential yards after catch potential, which, again, I kind of have a problem with, because that's moving the chains consistently. Whereas you're protecting against a low percentage opportunity. Whereas I would much rather take away short yardage throws from the Bengals. And that's the kind of whole general spiel I have about why the Texans are kind of 6-3. The defense is kind of matured. It's not as a complete car wreck, even though they have lost most of their corners. The offense has progressed, and they played a combination of bad teams, but they also haven't been bad enough to get beaten by them. So it's a weird conflict. It's a weird convergence of events where they just managed to stick it out and just, like, okay, this is a good enough team to get 6-3 on a schedule which has bad teams kind of littered across it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good summation of it. I think it's kind of what you just said, where, you know, they kind of start off slow. I think the New England game did affect them too. And then you go into an easier schedule where the quarterbacks aren't as good. The best quarterback they played since week 3 is Andrew Luck, you know, and that was Luck before he could throw the ball faster than, you know, 30 miles per hour. And then you have the easy schedule, the one possession wins. You have Bill O'Brien doing smart things in offense, which includes more, you know, play actions, more rollouts, more deep throws, even though sometimes they completely stop doing it. More chipping, which we'll talk about here in a second too. And then defensively, Cornell's done a really good job navigating his players, getting the younger guys more snaps than they should, utilizing Justin Reed a whole lot more. And also Jadeveon Clowney and J.J. Watt went from providing zero pass rush in the first 3 weeks of the season to being, you know, probably the best, like, defensive end tandem that you can have in football. Even though I don't really think you can be a tandem if you're defensive ends, because you put on the opposite side of the line of scrimmage, but I think you understand what I'm saying. They're like on opposite ends of the OK corral, you know. And if you're in the center of it, you don't want that to have happened, though, for it. But, yeah, I mean, I think overall, like, it's good they've won 6 games. There's a lot of fluke behind their 6 wins. There is also a lot of fluke behind their 0-3 start. But their 0-3 start, there is, center of their 6-0, you know, recent run, their 0-3 start. There's reasons that you can point to, like, why this team was so dumb in losing and why this team is better now in winning. But, you know, overall, like, I think 6-3 is a fine record for them. About what they should have, either 6-3 and 5-4 is probably about where they should be at. If you're, like, super optimistic, you should say, well, this team should probably be, you know, 7-1, because they should have won these 6 games. They should beat the Titans, they should beat the Giants. They're better than those two teams and never beat New England. But, you know, those are two different things. So I think they're about right where they should be. Probably, I kind of lean more, they should probably be 5-4 than 6-3 based on how they played this year. But, you know, it's kind of splitting hairs at that point. And regardless, they're, you know, AFC South leaders at the moment. And, you know, I think that there's no way they don't make the playoffs this year either.
Yeah, I could kind of see 5-4 considering that Denver game and just how close that was. Also, the Dallas game, just like, again with the weird combination of just bad quarterback plays. The Texans have got really lucky in terms of the head coaches that they faced. Like it's been a real like from I think it was Frank Reich in Indianapolis to Vance Joseph in Denver. There have been some bizarre play calls on the other side of the league, which has been a welcome difference to watch. But just those like the certain kind of things of just like we can't take these wins as just a complete mandate complete referendum on the fact that yeah, this team's good.
Mm-hmm.
The context has got to be applied here, and we've got to be apt in it. Just prognosticate going forward, this team could very well end up winning 10 games this season. And yeah, that, like, again, more than half of those wins might be one score games. And again, we might be back at, was it 2 years ago? Yeah, it was 2 years ago when a lot of the wins, where I think it was the 9-7 season. Where it was a lot of one-score games. We got to the playoffs, and it was like, okay, we're plucky. We think we can do this. Let's just hope we get the Bengals in the wild card round. Otherwise, we're screwed.
And instead, they had Matt McGloin, and that was the year they went 8-4 in one-score games.
Oh, yeah, that was the Connor Cook year!
Yeah, no, yeah, it was Matt McGloin, Connor Cook. They went 8-4 one-score games. Then the defense has probably the best defensive game they've ever played against New England. In New England, they create all that interior pressure, interior pressure. AJ Boye picked off Tom Brady, and like they should have won that game. If Matt Moore was their quarterback, they would have won that game. And instead, good old name redacted.
I'm just having a horrible, horrible flashback to Will Fuller dropping that touchdown pass from Marcus. Redacted.
Yeah. And that was the one play, like the one pass he hit, and that had to be caught. For them to win that game. It wasn't. And they also gave up a return touchdown, and then another return that took them all the way to 25. And then Bill O'Brien kicked a field goal at fourth and four from New England's own, 17-yard line. And Houston never got that close for the rest of the game either. Just all around, it wasn't a talent issue. It was just a kind of like an incompetence issue.
I'm just getting horrible, horrible, and just beautiful flashbacks at the same time. I just remember after I think it was the kickoff return touchdown, I think the camera cut to I think it was a special teams coach who was Larry. I can't remember what was his name. His second name was Izzo.
Yeah,
and I just the face of him just going like oh, like it cuts to him just as he's about to say oh f word.
Yeah,
which I can't say. But it's just like I was so happy that I managed to catch that. But just that image and like that looping gif in my head is just it's what I'm ever forever gonna remember from that game. It's just no.
Yeah. So you were talking about the offense a little bit, and before I ask you about Deshaun Watson, let's talk a little bit about the chipping they've done. And so it became really apparent like week one against the Patriots that they're gonna have trouble pass blocking because the Patriots don't have that good of an edge rush. They're mediocre, but they really were kind of all over Watson that game. The Titans were especially, but the Titans also got a bunch of free rushers against five wide receiver sets with nobody even in the backfield at all. And they hit Watson. I think they sacked Watson like five times or so that game. And so at that point, you're like, they need to do something. Like Derek Morgan, Harold Landry, and Brian Arakpo aren't that good. They need to help out their tackles on the edge. Julian Davenport should not be playing right tackle. He should be playing left tackle. They're wasting everybody's time by doing these sorts of things. And that was week two. And then it took, a month after that, 5 weeks after that. And now the offensive line is doing what they should be doing and the scheme's doing what they should be doing. Or Davenport's playing left tackle. Kendall Lamb has gone from completely unplayable and being one of the worst offensive tackles I've ever seen to being, pretty solidly unspectacular, which is saying so much. And I'm super proud of him and everything he's accomplished to go from what he was last year and years previously. Like, even as a sixth offensive lineman blowing, 12 blocks a game and getting caught with four holding penalties to being a pretty okay player right now has been super awesome to watch. And also, Brian's been helping out their tackles a lot by running split shotgun sets with Lamar Miller and Alfred Blue and helping Chip. Jordan Thomas is doing a really good job chipping. Even Ryan Griffin got on some chipping last weekend, which I never thought I'd see. Like, he actually hit a guy off the line of scrimmage, which was unbelievable. And but these are the things that should take in, should have happened in week two. It took O'Brien, you know, 5 weeks for them to become main parts of the offense. And so there's no, like, now that we're here, it's great. It should have happened sooner, and it's kind of whatever. But it's just kind of like another example of, you know, why, like, you know, there's so many frustrations that we have with O'Brien, regardless of the team's win-loss record is immediately. So, Luke, now that you saw this happen and have kind of enjoyed watching the chips and these sorts of things, do you have any reason why it didn't happen sooner? Did they want to, like, stay with more spread concepts because that's the offense O'Brien wanted to run and that was the best offense for Watson? Or is just something that, you know, they just kind of didn't see and it took them a little bit longer to realize than it should have?
I think it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. The pass attempts from the first five games would lead me to believe, okay, I think O'Brien wanted this to be a very quick, very short passing offense, which kind of moved the ball just like very slowly, very incrementally. Essentially what it used to be in the New England system, which was pass and cuts. And then the reality set in, and I think alongside that was the, okay, we've got a new offensive line. We've got two new interior guards. We've got a tackle who was looking sort of promising last year. We can put him out there and let him play, see if there's any progression. And we've got a new right tackle also. So there's no guarantee that things aren't going to be terrible. And I think it's that there's no guarantee. And he took that as, okay, let's try and see where this goes. And that got to around about game three or four and Deshaun Watson's broken ribs before he was like, okay, this isn't sustainable. We can't keep doing this. We've got to kind of readjust. That being said, there was a huge amount of overhaul in the offensive line the first few weeks. Players were either getting injured or just getting switched around, or like you had the weird Martinez Rankins, Julian Davenport, whose tackle side is it anyway, kind of thing, where one was playing on the left, the other was playing on the right, then one was playing on the left, the other was playing on the right. Centrell Henderson, rip him. He lasted, what was it, 2-3 snaps into the season before he suffered a torn ACL, I believe.
He broke his ankle.
Torn his ankle, which is, you know, completely different. And then you had, like, Kendall Lamb coming in and actually being quite good. One of the things which I was kind of struck by watching the Denver tape this weekend was from last weekend was, yeah, Kendall Lamb's actually made some progress. He's not completely abhorrent. And sometimes with the offensive line, I feel an offense can kind of scheme around them. You can create passing opportunities. You can bring in stuff like kicks. You can bring in stuff like people. Of course, you can have additional blockers in there to kind of buy them a little bit of extra time. And that can kind of help them. And essentially, an offensive line can operate on just being okay. I remember, I think it was NFL.com's Daniel Jeremiah, who was a former scout with Ravens. He was telling this anecdote about how when they were in the Ravens draft room, they would always get a noise at whichever offensive lineman the Colts would take, because they'd take them in like the fifth or sixth round. And they would go into the Colts system, which was super quick passing. Peyton Manning's getting the ball out in like one or two seconds, essentially allowing no pressure to ever occur. And he was essentially turning these offensive linemen, who we don't know what they would be like in any other system, into all pros, because they were just pass protecting for like 1 or 2 seconds and never allowing any pressure. But that kind of thing of just like, you can kind of scheme this stuff around an offensive line is very much like a situational kind of thing. You can create different situations which can benefit them. Now, I'm gonna go into the Denver game in particular, because this is the one that I'm most familiar with and I'm writing about it right now. What the kind of obvious thing that any team should do against Houston is blitz. 5-on-5, the Texans offensive line is not good. It will crumble. They're not good enough that they can hold on forever and ever. Especially if you have two really, really good, if you have a Von Miller on one side, you need to chip against Von Miller. So that takes an additional person to do that. And it takes away what the offense can do as a whole in terms of composition, in terms of play calling. think about it in terms of how many wide receivers am I taking away from the red shirt? Now, last year, during Watson's really prominent run, the Texans were taking everyone and just put it in, like, say, like 7-8-man protections and just letting Will Fuller and DeAndre Hopkins run routes, which worked perfectly well because Fuller's speed was a force multiplier. It required multiple different defenders to kind of be aware of the fact that, okay, I have to cover from here to here, and then the safety has to kind of bracket him over the top. Otherwise, he's just going to blow straight passes. And that's the kind of thing. But when you take force multipliers like Fuller's speed or his route running and stuff like that away from the game, you kind of have to reorientate yourself towards something a little bit more viable. Mm-hmm. So what the chipping and what the additional blockers have kind of done has allowed the Texans to kind of create a little bit more time for Watson, which is what he needs. It's really fun to watch as a whole. And actually, this is another key fact of what I think has helped the Texans as a whole. If you're taking tight ends out of inline position, if you're putting them like a little bit off to the right or to the left, you can still have them chip in at the sides and still, like, if you're playing against a 7-tech rusher, you can still have them attack them from the side and knock off their momentum and balance, which is what they did a lot in the Denver game, and is really, really interesting to watch because both Chubb and Miller, midway through about around third or fourth quarter, after they had taken a couple of, like, massive hits from the side by both Jordan Thomas, Jordan Atkins, and even Ryan Griffin, was the fact that they didn't attack the edge and they didn't attack their blocker with the same ferocity because they were expecting somebody to come in and wham them from the side. Go back and watch DeAndre Hopkins' touchdown, and you'll see Von Miller gets absolutely blindsided by Jordan Thomas. And this was the kind of thing that they had in their back of their minds for the rest of the game, was just like, oh, am I going to get chipped here? Am I going to get blown off the side? Like, these kind of things, they're small incremental things, but they help the offensive line as a whole just create a better environment for them to succeed. Like, and that's what the chipping, that's what the additional blockers has been. It's not been just like, hey, listen, we're gonna leave you out on an island against four pass rushers who are probably gonna be better than you and just hope you do good. It's gonna be like, okay, we're gonna try and help you whatever way you can. And again, it's like, it helps in terms of confidence things also. If your offensive line is just getting roasted play after play after play, he's gonna get demotivated. So helping them in that sense, it also kind of just builds a little bit of confidence, builds that, okay, on that one or two plays that we're gonna run five wide sets, okay, we're gonna trust you to do this. We're gonna trust you to be able to block for 3 to 4 seconds while we have DeAndre Hopkins run a quick slot or a quick curl, which is what they usually do when they run five wide sets. They'll have Hopkins in the slot and they will run just a very, very quick route that requires 2 or 3 seconds of Deshaun Watson reading it and the pass comes in. That's a bit interesting. But the other part of that too is that they're taking players out of the box, which helps massively in the run game. If you're only running against seven every single time, that's great. You can kind of just help them scheme towards that. If you're bringing inline tight ends and stacking them up in like three tight end sets along the line, you're drawing safeties down into the box and you're making it harder for yourself, you're making it harder on yourself to run the football, which is, I think, something that the Texans should probably slide away from a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the one thing I want to add too about the importance of chipping, and you're talking about where Von Miller and Bradley Chubb, they stop edge rushing, is that one, it also elongates the block. So whenever you have a chip there, even if you're not bashing his ribs in, knock him down, you're allowing the tackle to sit and wait for the edge rusher. They're not having to hurry up. They're not turning their shoulders. They're not opening up the gate and allowing the edge rusher to get around him at all. They're the ones being sent to the punch now, and they're the ones intercepting the rush. It's kind of like a basketball player guarding the rim. You don't want him playing one-on-one against the point guard driving in. You want him guarding the rim as standing there waiting for him, not, you know, playing one-on-one with him off the dribble. And then the second thing it does too is, like you mentioned, it removes the edge rush and they become one-dimensional where they're just waiting for inside rushes and bull rushes and those sorts of things. And it's so much easier as a pass blocker whenever you have to only deal with one thing rather than two or three things. And so they just are able to, you know, take a shorter pass set, wait for the inside rush. And as long as they don't give up anything or any blitzes or stunts, they're going to be okay. And I think the one of the other important things you said too that I really liked was just the demoralizing factor of getting beat over and over again, you know, by the tackles on the edges. And like if you're a tackle, like in the professional football, you've played a lot of football before. You know how football works. So like if you're getting beat by, you know, if you're getting beat by Jerry Hughes over and over again, and you're Julian Davenport, Davenport knows that Bill O'Brien can help him out with a running back or a tight end or do something to help him out there. And like when your coach isn't helping you out whenever you're struggling, I think it's also like really demoralizing and it, you know, hurts your confidence and it sucks to just go out there and keep getting beat over and over again without being reciprocated with it all, without any help whatsoever. And so since O'Brien's doing that, I think also by winning some pass blocks and making things easier, it's also helped the confidence of Lamb and Davenport. And Davenport just looks like he's moving a lot better too. And so it's been like, it's not as heartbreaking anymore to watch the Texans offensive line. Cause I was miserable like week 3 and 4. Like I wanted to cry every time I watched Davenport get beat. You know, he's like a hipster, you know, I saw him first sort of love. I'm excited. I've been excited watching him play. It's been a lot better now than it was the first few weeks.
Yeah, he still gives up his chest. Like, I can't believe, like, he just has no, like, one interesting thing about Bradley Chubb that I noticed from watching a couple of games is he attacks the outside shoulder really, really strong. And he'll look to just plant one arm in your chest and essentially just run you around. Davenport his hands are really, really interesting. Whereas Kendall Lamb on the other side tries to get a really good punch in every single time. He's aggressive like that. Davenport will just essentially try and widen his stance as wide as possible and just try and like steer the, like be an obstacle, be an obstruction to the pass rusher. Which again, that's kind of his job. But he does it in such a weird way that I haven't seen before. He'll be just like, yeah, I'm gonna give up my center of gravity, but I don't care. Okay, I'm just gonna plant my foot, be a sumo wrestler. That's all he's attempting to do. And it's really, really funny to watch. Again.
He's like the shopping cart whenever you go down the same aisle in the grocery store.
Yeah, it's just like, oh god, I have to try and get around this. It's a nuisance. And like if an offensive lineman is a nuisance, I'd say he's doing his job.
Yeah. So we got super in depth with this kind of part of the show. So I guess, do you have any other like big Texans thoughts that you want to say? Like, do you feel strongly about, you know, Tyrann Mathieu and Kareem Jackson? Do you have any like tears of red down your face when Alpha Blue gets a carry? Is there anything else specifically you want to talk about Texans before we go through some of these, you know, silly little awards that I have here?
So, I mean, there are a couple of things which I can think of kind of just like random kind of noticed things that I've noticed over the past couple of weeks. I do think Bill O'Brien's trying to slim down the amount of pass attempts that Deshaun Watson's going to have game to game. I do think ideally, I don't think he wants him to throw the ball more than 30 times a game. I don't think he wants to go back to what week 1, 2, and 3 were, which were, okay, spread offense, let's try and throw this 40 times a game. I don't think he's going to do that. I also, what really interests me too is that if you're looking to create easier, like high percentage looks for your offense, one of the best ways that we've seen to do that in the NFL right now in particular is give the ball to your running back in the passing game. And the Texans just haven't done that. Here's the thing. The Texans, between Lamar Miller, Alfred Blue, and Tyler Irvin, God rest his soul, all three of them have 38 targets total. That's ridiculously, or sorry, that's really, really low for a running back in a modern NFL offense, or what it has been, essentially, for this year. The idea of, especially Lamar Miller, where it's like, this guy is really, really good when you put him in space, so why wouldn't you look to try and get him outside of tackles and get him involved in the passing game a little bit more? It's been one of those kind of weird things where these are easily generated throws that Deshaun Watson gets, which you can kind of integrate into the offense and essentially create yards after catch possibilities, and those are easy enough yards for you to create. Right? It's just a simple screen pass or just pass into the flat. It's a way in which you can actually move the ball and get your quarterback easy completions. Look at what the Jacksonville Jaguars did with Blake Bortles and TJ Yeldon. Really, really simple throws, high possibility or some potential to get more orders. So it's just a small, simple thing like that, which could be seen to help improve things. In terms of looking at like a larger, I kind of like want to switch over to defense a little bit here. Looking at the larger meta structure, the larger kind of structure of the defense as a whole, they're still running cover four, which again, I don't think it's the best coverage scheme in the world. I don't think the corners are really the best to do it. Yeah, there are certain kind of things which really work well. I think Tyrann Mathieu has actually been a great, great improvement over the five-headed Kamara that was KJ Dillon, Curtis Drummond, Eddie Pleasant, Corey Moore, and Marcus Gilchrist. It's depressing that I know all the names of the safeties that played for the Texans last season. All five of those were garbage. I don't think I'm really burning the hot take there by saying that. Mathieu as a whole is actually really, really quite good. He doesn't get fooled on really, really simple stuff. He's very athletic, so he can push down cover into cover any slot receivers if you want to disguise the Matt Rizzo look. He's got some really, really good placements, he's got really, really good positioning, and he can actually bracket receivers pretty well without just getting straight up burned. Those things are minor, but if they're done well, yeah, the Texans defense actually looks better because of it. I think I kind of said this earlier. The deep passer rating for the Texans is really quite good, and Tyrann Mathieu has a big part to do with that. Also, the fact that, yeah, he's a really versatile blitzer, and he can come down into the box, and that he can blitz on occasion. He's done quite well. He's gotten two sacks. He's a solid tackler also. He's not Kareem Jackson. Oh, my goodness, how is a guy of this size this good at tackling? But he's competent to a degree that, you know, is helpful. It's like sometimes it's just about not being a net negative. It's not something that is an active detriment to the team. And Tyrann Mathieu is that. He's not an active detriment to the team, and in a couple of cases, he's actually positive. If you want to really prognosticate look down the road, the real question is he good enough to get re-signed over Kareem Jackson? Or is he good enough that you might want to cut Andre Hall? That's a completely different question, because Justin Reed is definitely staying on the team. The Texans cannot cut any young talent off this team. They literally can't, especially in the secondary, where there's just nobody, apart from now Justin Reed, who is going to progress through anytime soon. Unless, you know, Kevin Johnson suddenly regains the form that he had during his first two seasons. But that's a different kind of thing to talk about. I think the Texans are probably going to keep Kareem Jackson around, obviously, because he has just been ridiculously good this season. Having him play the slot corner or the safety where you know, ask him to play the outside zone in cover four, where you would have like three short zones and the four deep zones. He is just really, really good at covering those that outside third zone really, really well. He's a corner essentially, so he can just flit in and out of that very, very fast. He's a solid tackler, so that if a receiver does catch the ball off like a three yard reception, there is no chance of yards up the catch because Kareem Jackson is tackling them. They are going down. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. He is just making sure that they are not getting any yards up the catch. So that's really, really cool. Texans pass rush has been a little bit interesting, solely because the fact that this is actually going to be our first strong sample size of what J.J. Watt and J.J. McClellan kind of do together. It's been interesting watching. Again, those first couple of weeks were terrifying a little bit, but just because nothing was happening as a whole. And I think they've kind of regained their mojo, and there's a really interesting kind of coherency here that's going on with them. In particular, I don't think what Romeo Crennel is doing with Clowney in particular is really interesting. Clowney's most successful rushes are coming now on the interior. This is what Romeo Crennel's always been really good at doing, is that generating interior pressure, I'm going to line up Jadeveon Clowney and Whitney Mercilus over some guards. And, you know, the guards who are just not that fast or not that agile are just being asked to stop guys who are really, really quick and have really, really quick hands. And that usually doesn't end well. I mean, the Clowney sack that he had against Denver was essentially just he steps strongly off of his right hand side, swims pretty much over the left guard, center doesn't close fast enough, and Cloudy just barrels straight through. And that's sometimes that's all it is. Cloudy's he's a freak of nature. He's fast, he's quick. Just use that against guys who are just large and slow, and that's all you have to do in some of this. Whitney Merciless is a little bit concerning. I will say he's creating disruption, but not production. I've noticed a couple of good instances of him getting into backfield or just even holding the edge on a rush where he's not the one to finish the play, but he's the one that's actually holding in place for crowds. The production, I hope, will come somewhere along the next of the season. It has been picking up slightly over the past couple of weeks, but as a whole, it's nothing really to be super concerned about. Now, when we go to the offseason and we start to look back over this and whether or not, because I think Whitney Merciless might become a trade candidate, I think we could look back at this season, and if he hasn't had the same kind of production, I think we could have questions of just is he really worth this? Could we kind of rebuild, or could we just switch to a 4-3? Just have Watt and Clowney on the edges, have Dylan Cole return, and have a McKinney, Cunningham, and Cole linebacker. And just Merciless is kind of superfluous. Let's try and see if we can flip him for a traffic, or if we can flip him for some secondary. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
And then even maybe run an over front with that reader playing the three technique there too, and two gapping.
Yeah, exactly. There are a couple of things that you could do, but it's kind of about just measuring what you've got right now. What else? We're going to have Dante Foreman coming back in a couple of weeks, which is going to be super, super interesting, mostly because it stops Alfred Blue having carries. I'm saying that while furiously crossing most of my bandages. One of the really, really fun things about Alfred Blue run this season has been he's gone from treating every run like the 4-yard mark is his heroin, and as soon as he gets the ball, he needs his fix, to being very, it's a really, really interesting, he's gone to almost like Le'Veon Bell style, super upright, so he's trying to read the entire offensive line in front of him, and he's stuttering and stopping and trying to pick a hole and then burst through it, but he doesn't have the burst. There were a couple of real weird instances where he would stop, stutter, kind of just run and just appear on the other side of the line. He'd get past the first level, and he'd be just like, how did he do that? And then you'd just be like, he just gets smashed straight afterwards by a linebacker because he just couldn't outrun. They would make the first level blocks, but before any of them could get to the second level and seal off the blocks or any of the support could come in, he would just get to the second level and just well, I don't have the speed to run away from anyone else. So this is, it looks like we're getting 7 yards instead of 4 now, guys, mm-hmm. Which is interesting, but at the same time, it's not consistent. That's one instance where it happens, but it's not every time it happens because, you sometimes do just need to be a blunt force and, getting 3 or 4 yards is kind of, that's kind of his deal. I applaud him for trying to diversify his running style, but that's about it. I mean it sucks that Will Fuller's gone because he really changes what the offense does and how it looks on a snap basis. I'm gonna be very interested to see what they do with Demaryius Thomas. I have no idea what the touch distribution is going to be like. Because during the couple of weeks in which Keke Coutee was a big part of our offense, Will Fuller's targets just absolutely tanked. He had an average of, I think, maybe 2 or 3 targets per game. It was really, really low, and you were just like, okay, what's going on here? So it's going to be interesting to see, is that secondary outside receiver going to get that similar treatment? And is Coutee and Hopkins going to kind of be the primary focus of the offense just because either the matchups are kind of beneficial towards those two, or, Hopkins is just really talented and we're just going to throw him the ball just because, he's eventually just going to make some plays and get you yardage. So, that's going to be one of the things which I also want to look out for. It's just what's Demaryius Thomas's usage number is going to be like. What's he going to be doing on a snap-to-snap basis? Is he going to be doing the Nate Washington Memorial hey, just run a go route. What's the worst thing? Similarly speaking, if you also want to have some fun during Texans games, watch whatever happens when running backs get put out wide. Specifically, sometimes the Texans do this in motion, which is to kind of help Deshaun Watson get a better recognition of what kind of coverage scheme the defense is playing, i.e. if a DB or a safety comes down into the box to kind of trap the running back as he's going out, it might be a good indication of the man. If no one's following you out there, okay, it's an indication of something. Occasionally, what the Texans will do, what Bill O'Brien does, is he'll put Lamar Miller out to the perimeter on like the X receiver, and they'll ask him to run a go route. And they never targeted him on this route, and I cannot figure out why they keep doing it. It's really, really interesting, and I'm wondering if any defenses are just picking up on it. It's like, they're not going to throw to him. Should we even bother covering him? Like, it's a real kind of interesting thing to, like, just something completely random, something that doesn't really make sense to me, or I don't have a reason why it happens. I find it amusing, nonetheless, because it's one of those whimsically useless things that Bill O'Brien kind of does every now and then. And that's about it. That's my kind of general take on what I've seen so far this season, I guess.
Yeah, that was really good. I know, like, a lot of this stuff too, you know, watching the video, you get to see kind of like a little bit more of the general inside details. Like the Alfred Blue stuff, like I haven't watched an Alfred Blue all 22 carry and thought anything of it at all. Like, you know, whenever you watch this stuff with kind of clear eyes and really sit down, focus into it, you can have an idea of him trying to do his best Le'Veon Bell impersonation. It kind of reminds me of like somebody playing pickup basketball. He tries to, like, you know, do the Dirk Nowitzki shot of 1 foot, but has no touch at all whatsoever, and just clangs it off the backboard over and over again. And that's kind of like Alfred Blue trying to do the Le'Veon Bell.
Yeah, just furiously screaming, "Ball, no, ball, don't lie!" Whilst he's doing it.
Yeah, of course. That was cool. It was interesting because I know, like, with how busy you've been, like a lot of your Texans stuff is always interesting. I always enjoy hearing about it, but how busy you've been, it's been hard to put all into words and sit there and write something like really big and important and all that. But you can, you know, it's a lot easier to talk to. And that's the one thing that's kind of made me upset about doing these podcasts is that, like, doing a podcast is so much easier than writing. Like, writing is so much better and fulfilling and more interesting. And like, you better understand something after you do it. But, like, sitting here on this green couch in this green chair and, like, talking and listening to what you have to say, it's just so much easier with the same information coming into it, but without all the work, you know?
Yeah. I kind of confer with that also. Like, you don't get the same kind of background and you don't get the same kind of knowledge that you get from sitting down and from just watching it. You don't get to enjoy all the weird intricacies or just the minute details that just make you kind of happy. But at the same time, I think it's oftentimes very restricting, and just being able to kind of splurge it all out there and just being able to kind of verbally, what's the word I'm looking for here? just essentially to get it all out. To undam the river of Texans thoughts and takes that has been nice. I am getting back into writing. I have something coming in tomorrow about Texans offensive line, which is going to be my kind of first thing. And then we're going to hopefully try and do a little bit of incremental more work over the rest of the season.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, like, on my end, you know, I went to Las Vegas and I came back and I got sick. And then I went out last Friday, was stupid hungover on Saturday and couldn't ride and I wanted to. And then this week, my dog ate a bottle of Advil, so I had to go to the puppy hospital and couldn't write the thing I wanted to write. And then now I'm doing these podcasts tonight. So it's always a vicious battle. It's hard whenever you become an adult. You don't have as much free time to sit there and, you know, watch Texans all 22 and that sort of thing. But, you know, we manage as best we can.
Yes, these are our battles, and we wage a vicious war.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, somebody asked me the other day, like, you know, what do you think it's about being an adult? One of the things that makes me sick when somebody's like, "Oh, I came an adult today. I hate being an adult." Like, if somebody says they miss high school, I just want to throw them off a cliff. You know, that stuff sucks. But, you know, being an adult is cool. And like, you're just kind of firmly in it, you know, and it doesn't end until you retire. And then when you retire, you die. And it's, but at the same time, like, this is nice because I have a bunch of free time and live two different lives. So I go to work and leave work and I have like, you know, a ton of free time, my off time. And like, you're just kind of firmly in it, you know, you don't really even think about everything else. You just kind of get in a groove and you're in it and you're just in it forever, you know?
Yeah. No, yeah. That's one of the things, especially with like working full time, like I did last year. You become just like comfortably numb in the position. It's just like, oh, this is nice. I could kind of get used to this. And then you're just like, for me, I'm always of the mindset that I kind of need to keep doing stuff. I can't sit still. I'm just, it's one of those things where if my brain stops for a second, I'm just like really, really antsy. Like I kind of need to exhaust myself before I can relax. It's also why whenever I go on holidays, it's usually just, I'm going to go hike today. I'm going to go swimming. I'm going to do something to tire myself. That way I can just kind of like lay by a beach somewhere and just like slowly turn. That's the kind of way in which I operate. But just kind of getting out of those things and just getting out of the day-to-day monotony and trying to find time and trying to realize it's just like, okay, am I going to have time to do this week? Or like, am I going to have time to go to the gym? Am I going to have time to work? Am I going to be able to, you know, do some cooking and do some, actually make myself a nice meal instead of, you know, getting out of work and just being like, oh, just feed me sustenance so I don't die. those kind of small things. If you can work them in, then it's worth it.
Yeah. I think the way I kind of describe it now for me is just being like comfortably bored whenever I'm at work and stuff. But it's, as soon as I leave work, I unbutton my shirt like four buttons down. I'm ready to party because I'm going back home and do whatever I can do anything I want to do.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's the best thing to do. It's just like, as soon as you leave work or school or whatever, just unbutton that shirt like four buttons and, you know, become a different person.
Yeah, it's just like, no, I wore a tie and it was just like, first thing I do is like, get this damn noose off of me.
Yeah.
Just throw it into the bag. It's like, I'm done. Not doing this for the rest of the day. My neck needs to breathe. Let it breathe.
It's kind of the opposite of like the Batman signal, where like the signal comes on, puts the suit on, and you know, now it's like, you see the sun, you feel the sunlight, and you take the suit off, you know?
Yeah, it's just like, no, I need to be naked, and I need to be naked now.
Yeah. I know what you mean, though. And the other thing I wanted to say, because I don't think, we won't have enough time to go over the awards. We're already at about an hour right now, and so we can do that for another week or, you know, a different show. But the one thing I want to say, I talked to BFD about yesterday too, was just how much I've enjoyed football this year. Because I was horrified. I wasn't looking forward to it at all. I was dreading the season starting just from all the rules that were made about contact, the constant, you know, discussion about everything aside from football, different owners being terrible people, different players being terrible people, some of the decisions, you know, Houston made as well too. And just like the constant just drag of it all. And also, I was just super enjoying, you know, reading books by John Renane and just thinking about, like, you know, take the color, this color water made me think about taking a bath as a child, that sort of thing. And so I was really enjoying, like, being super, you know, literary in that mindset. I wasn't looking forward to this year at all. And then, like, these past 3 weeks, now that defenses are kind of caught up, now that people can tackle well, now that they're used to the new speed of offenses, and we're seeing a lot more, you know, 28-21 games instead of everything being, you know, 35, you know, 27, and games are actually more well played, more managed. They mean things. You know, there's not as many touchdowns. Like, I really have loved watching football these past 2 weeks. And I think it's the most I've enjoyed watching the league as a whole, I think, in my entire life. Because before, the NFL was like supplementary to the Texans, you know, and then now it's kind of the Texans are supplementary to the NFL, just because there's so many, there's like seven really great teams that you can watch and, you know, have a blast watching. And the Texans are just kind of like that family member. It's like going to like your family dinner, you know, like at 6 o'clock, but Friday and Saturday nights where you really enjoyed your weekend. And then Sunday, you know, you're just doing this thing because you always do it. And so I've just really enjoyed what these offenses have done, how the defenses are now catching up a little bit, and just how much like, and how quick the game has changed too. But this year has been a lot of fun in the last three or four weeks or so, especially.
Yeah. No, I kind of agree with that too. Like a good few degrees in that there's so many interesting players out there. There's so many players that like we haven't seen in a long time, or we haven't seen their kind, or just we haven't seen the way in which they've been utilized. And as a whole, it's very rewarding to see offenses in general, like ones run in Kansas City, the ones run in Philadelphia, the ones run in Los Angeles, that make a lot of sense. Maybe it's just I've been conditioned by watching Bill O'Brien too much. And it's just like, why does this dumb thing happen? Oh, it just happens. You know, we can't explain why. It just does. It's nice to see someone actually think about, okay, what's the best formation that I can run here that best augments my running back? And I have three really good wide receivers. Let's try and do something there. Yeah, let's run three wide sets. Let's not cram up the box. Let's have an extra tight end there that can help with the blocking, act as a potential fullback, or, you know, chip and peel if we want to create extra protection. And then we have just three receivers running routes the entire time. Like if we're attacking, say, a team that's playing cover three or cover four, okay, let's say if you're the Rams, let's have somebody who's going to attack a deep seam, run a deep seam route and attack the right in between the middle deep zone and say the right deep zone. Okay, those two are drawn there. Let's run, say, Cooper Kupp running a 10-yard out route underneath that. That's creating space underneath there, and it's putting Cooper Kupp on a long route. It's just something really smart and really nice and kind of the word that just came into my head was wholesome. There's just like wholesome offenses just taking apart defense, which just sounds absolutely ridiculous in my head. It's like I'm trying to put it into words. For me, it's the nice mix of offense as a whole just becoming really, really punctuated, and that's where I find the most interest is kind of in the offense. And then it's the kind of theory crafting that I've done by myself about what's going to be the counter now. Because the NFL, if we've learned over the past couple of years, is just... I'm just reading something about Le'Veon Bell here. No, he's just... one of the things which I was kind of thinking about was... we saw with Seattle's defense, cover three, and how teams started to counteract that after the fact that they'd proven, okay, this is a really, really good system that kind of works well. It has a lot of unique individual players that augment it make it a lot better. Like, say, you can have cover three with press corners. That just doesn't happen. It shouldn't happen. It's essentially just playing cover one, which, you know, would be crazy. But it works because you've got Richard Sherman and Brandon Browner who are jamming receivers off the line of scrimmage. They stop them straight up. It works because you have Cam Chancellor, who's essentially a linebacker-safety hybrid. And this is one of the things which, like, I started crafting what I thought would be the best way to run a defense in a really pass-centric NFL, which to my mind, and you kind of touched on it when we were emailing a couple of weeks back, was something along the lines of 4-2-5. It's a three safety look, but that third safety is something in the mix of a linebacker and a safety. It's something like a Cam Chancellor. You could potentially still put in the box, but on passing downs, you can just, okay, let's put him over Travis Kelce or Rob Gronkowski and just act like ask him to cover. So, and like the way I kind of thought about it too is that maybe we're coming at this from the wrong point of like, maybe this new rotation of NFL offense is actually sustainable. Maybe this is actually what the norm is going to be. Now, defenses might adjust, but their offenses are always going to kind of be one or two steps ahead. So why instead, in a league that's increasing its passing attempts, why don't we start thinking about it in terms of, instead of trying to stop somebody, let's try and create turnovers. If the games are going to be 45-42 shootouts like it is in the Big 12, why don't we just create those one or two extra possessions by focusing turnovers as much as possible so that our offense can try and go out there and score? Instead of trying to play almost in a, like an impossible game of just like, can we cover every receiver out here and every route and still be able to protect the run? Probably not. And off, like, Sean McVay is probably going to come up with a way to counter that. What's the name of the Doug Peterson's probably going to come way able to come up with that. You're going to have various additional factors such as Kansas City with Tyreek Hill. We have a way to counter this. Not really. No one can cover him on deep routes. We can kind of bracket him, but then somebody else is going to get loose underneath. So you're going to concede somewhere. So why don't we just completely reshape the way that we think about this in terms of, let's not try to stop teams from scoring. Let's try to stop teams from having the ball, and let's try and create extra possessions for us.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think a lot of it also is just being able to, like you were talking about the Rams and your three wide receiver sets. I think their offense works mainly because of Todd Gurley, and so they always have four wide receivers. And also it's the same thing as the Kubiak step, but now it's like, rather than it just being one play leads to another play, it's one, like seven plays lead to, you know, 35 different plays where you have the same personnel and same sort of formations, and then you run like your five or six different base plays, and then that leads to everything else. Everything looks alike. And if you have a defense, you know, each key doesn't matter because the next thing, it can be an entirely different play off any step and off anything that occurs. And so, I think defenses will keep – I don't know if it's really the defensive schemes that are going to adjust. It's just the defensive players getting used to the speed and tackling and hitting and all that. I think it's the biggest thing that has changed the past few weeks. But I'm just glad in general, you know, that you two and like a lot of people I've talked to have just like really enjoyed football the past 3 weeks, especially with everything about how the game is dying and it's all going to end. And maybe it is. Maybe this is the last flicker before – you know, the inferno or whatever, but it's been fun as hell the past few weeks.
I mean, like the uber pessimist pseudo nihilist in me is going, yeah, this game isn't sustainable as is most heavy contact sports like rugby, like American football. Even you could argue ice hockey is probably going to be going the way of the dinosaurs. That's a completely different discussion, but.
Well, you know who's the interesting player, though, to watch is Luke Kuechly nowadays because he's had, you know, five concussions. He had that awful one where he was, you know, crying on the field, like, confused. And now when you watch him play, he doesn't use his head at all when he plays anymore. He's constantly pushing guys out of bounds. He's grabbing guys and tossing them and throwing them. He doesn't really even tackle at all anymore. And so I think that's kind of – I know a lot of stuff that's been said about CTE is a lot of it's hereditary. So hopefully you can have like some sort of genetic test to understand if you have it or not. And if you have it, you know, you could potentially still play these sorts of games. You just play different positions or play differently. And then also maybe if you have two concussions and want to keep playing football, you can do something like Luke Kuechly has done this year where like everything is with his shoulder. He's constantly, you know, twisting and grabbing and throwing. He's not using his head whenever he hits, you know, like guards who come up in the run game. He's using his speed a lot more. And so it's like, it's really interesting to see like a guy who's one hit away from his entire career being over to playing, you know, nine games so far this year in an entirely different style and still being an incredible player without having as much physicality that he's had before in the past.
Yeah. No, as you were talking about that, I just had just a weird flashback from, I think it was the Bears Dolphins game that I was watching. And just the memory I have of like Leonard Floyd suplexing Akeem Grant. I've got the GIF of it somewhere on my other computer, and I'll send it to you after I'm done here. It kept coming back into my head of just like this guy. Like it was one of the stupidest things you've ever seen on a football field, but he just freaking flings them around like he's like they're in a WWE match or something. It's really, I just couldn't stop laughing at it.
Yeah, I saw that, and I really like watching Jakeem Grant play as well too. Like he's so fast. He's like, you know, he's like Tariq Cohen. Except probably not used as well as Cohen's used in Chicago. And so that's exciting, you know, what they can do with Grant, especially when Tannehill gets back and they have a guy who can throw the ball downfield to open up more of their shorter stuff.
Oh, yeah. He had this really, really sexy, like, curl and go route, like, essentially against, I think it was in the Bears game also, where he just absolutely roasted the DB. Like, he just pivots into a curl route and then turns his left shoulder as the DB crashes and just releases straight up field. Like it was I just did just like giddily just like rocking back and forth. It's like, yeah, yeah, that's the shit. That's the shit right there.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, so cool to watch. And like those are the kind of raids and those are the kind of moments which I'm just like, oh man, this is really, really fun to just like go through at a time. What was the player that I was looking at? Oh yeah, Kenyon Drake. Sorry, I've been watching far too much Miami, plus I have Kenyon Drake on my fantasy team, so I'm super kind of obsessed with just holy shit, they need to give him more touches. He's the one thing that I came away with from watching the Miami take, which is actually really like one of the things which I kind of came away with that was a better appreciation of what Bill O'Brien's kind of gone through the past couple of years in terms of. If you've got a shit quarterback, you have got to do like a lot of stuff in order to make them comfortable. And winning football games is so freaking difficult. Mm-hmm. Like Gase was really, really smart in how he attacked a lot of the coverages. Like against the Bears who were running cover three, he was really, really smart in terms of he would stack three or like he would do three bunch three on one side, draw some of the zones over to one side of the field, and then essentially ask linebackers to cover across the field against wide receivers who are running crossing routes. And every single time, the wide receiver's beating them over and over and over again. It's really, really smart plays to kind of like punch receivers and seam routes are how you beat cover three. And he knew this. Okay, we'll generate quick short throws where it'll be wide receiver and linebacker, and we can kind of just manifest our way through that. Or they'll do clear out routes where they'll have same kind of similar setup, bunch three on one side, have two of them, like one of them running a post, one of them running an out, and one of them running a go. And all of that does is it clears all the zones out one side, you have a like Kenyon Drake running a flat to one side, dump it off to him, he's got 5 to 10 yards, free room before the first tacklers can, you know, and that's just an easy first down right there. And it's simple, interesting stuff like that, which is kind of giving me an idea of just like, man, if this is what like coaches do with quarterbacks, it's just like, what was Bill O'Brien doing? Like what? Like this is always the thing that I kind of as a Texans fan, it always comes back to just, man, why can't we do that? Like, if it's not even your offensive philosophy, okay, but there are certain things here that are kind of pretty much universal across scheme, creating space, being able to just generate good looks and being able to create like mismatches, which is what tight ends are usually using across a variety of different systems. But it's just those kind of things were never there. It was always just like, yeah, screw this. It's man-on-man coverage. We're just going to trust that DeAndre Hopkins can win 30 or 40 times a game on the curl route. Let's just keep doing that over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a good point, too, because, you know, it is hard to win football games, and the overall record's inflated. And that sort of thing. And I've always kind of stuck with the fact that the Texans have been, you know, an above average talent-wide team since, you know, probably 2008 or so. And one possession wins and bad luck have hurt them. Same thing with quarterback play and injuries. And, you know, with O'Brien's time, it was mainly the quarterback position. And last year it was injuries, but most of the quarterback position, I don't necessarily feel bad for him because he made a lot of the decisions that he made. He picked a lot of players. You know, he had say on a lot of players that were picked in those cases. He didn't use the draft capital whenever he had it. And a lot of that is entirely on him and his own, you know, his own ego to not have to spend a lot on a quarterback and trying to get so much out of these specific guys that he likes, even if they don't have the talent or whatever, because he can coach them up. And it didn't work. It got him 9 wins. And now with an actual, like, you know, really good quarterback who has talent, the Texans are on their way for the best season he's had as a coach the entire time. And so I think even like as much as we talk about scheme and all that stuff, the most important thing obviously is talent. And so if you have talent in football, like no matter like how hard it is to win games, those sorts of things, if you have talent, you can, you know, win 9 games. I think, you know, I wouldn't say easily, but comfortably with just like some pretty good middle manager, like being a middle manager at a Chili's, you can, with that level of competency and you have a high talented football team, you can win some games too at the same time.
Yeah. It's the don't be a liability
kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that'll be our show for tonight. It didn't go like exactly how it plans, but you know, sometimes you just kind of, it's like playing the jazz flute, you know, you kind of go here and there and everywhere. So I'm assuming, Luke, are you going to have this piece tomorrow for the Texas offensive line ready for everybody to read?
Yes, and if not, assume I'm dead.
Okay, and if not, there's always Monday, too. The Texans aren't playing game this week. So if you have it ready for Monday, everybody will be able to read it then at that time, too. But, yeah, if you just want to send me an email, I can edit it tonight probably after I go pick up the Advil dog. But anyway, thank you for listening to the show. Bye tonight. My name is Matt Weston. Thank you for being on tonight, Luke.
No problems. Thank you very much for having me, Matt.
I thought it was pretty good.
Hello, I'm Spencer Hall from SB Nation, and I want to tell you about my new show, It Seems Smart. It Seems Smart is a show about people doing things that, for some reason or another, seemed smart at the time. Those things might include doing a little cocaine and driving a bike up a mountain. Or, I don't know, maybe racing 100 miles per hour across the country in the middle of the night with no one's permission. Or even stealing a bat from an umpire's room in a Major League Baseball park. Check it out, and if you like it, tell a friend. I'm Spencer Hall. Don't do anything smart.